I'm Kai Wright, host of the United States of Anxiety, a podcast from WNYC. I'm in for Tanzina Vega, who'll be back on Friday. And vaccine hesitancy is where we start on The Takeaway today.
When I came into office, you may recall, I set a goal that many of you said was that kind of way over the top. I said I intended to get 100 million shots in people's arms in my first 100 days in office. Tonight, I can say we're not only going to meet that goal, we're going to beat that goal.
As the Biden administration ramps up its vaccination campaign, more and more Republicans are expressing skepticism about getting their COVID-19 shot. According to a CBS News poll, a third of Republicans have said they won't get vaccinated, with another 20% saying they're unsure. That's compared with just 10% of Democrats hesitant about getting vaccinated. At the same time, recent polling suggests that Black and Latinx Americans have become as willing, if not more willing, to get vaccinated than their white counterparts. There were some concerns early on about the possible hesitancy of these populations to get vaccinated, given the many ways that people of color encounter racism and prejudice inside the medical system. And while vaccine enthusiasm overall is on the rise, the Biden administration is kicking off a sweeping campaign to reduce vaccine hesitancy and combat misinformation in the weeks ahead, so that every eligible adult in the U.S. can and will get their shot. With me now is Dr. Leticia Ilopre, an assistant professor of infectious disease at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Dr. Ilopre, glad to have you with us.
Hi, happy to be here.
Also with us is Dan Diamond, a national reporter investigating health, politics, and policy for The Washington Post. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Kai, how are you?
I am well. Thanks for asking. So, Dan, let's start with a seemingly straightforward question. Why are so many Republicans hesitant to get vaccinated?
Well, I think it depends, Kai, which Republicans you talk to. But as someone who's reported on this for the Post for several weeks, I think the biggest concerns come down to concerns I've been hearing for months across a lot of demographic groups. They're worried about how fast the vaccine was developed. Some think that the risk of coronavirus is overblown. But I think the reason Republicans have cottoned on so much to this is because many believe that coronavirus, the response, and more recently the vaccine, has been used as a political weapon, first against President Trump last year leading up to the election, and more recently that President Biden and his team are using politics to shape the response as well. And that dates back to some of the resentments that President Trump stoked during the virus outbreak last year, and the ways that he attacked public health and blamed his election loss in part on what he claimed was an effort to submarine him using the outbreak. So I think that's where public health efforts really have their work cut out, trying to convince these Republicans to take politics out of public health.
The former president, Donald Trump, said on Fox last night that he encouraged his supporters to get vaccinated. Do you think that would matter to them, Dan?
I think it's definitely a good thing, but how much of a good thing is unclear. I had reported, I guess about a week ago, that pollsters like Frank Luntz, longtime Republican pollster who's now working on vaccine hesitancy, they believed that if President Trump just came out and told Republicans, go get this shot, that that would be powerfully motivating. But then I watched a focus group that Luntz convened of about 20 Trump voters. He asked them, how important is it if President Trump tells you to go get a shot? And to a person, they all said that they'd rather hear from their doctor, they'd trust their spouse more, which makes sense. But I think it also shows that President Trump might not be the single answer here. Their hesitation was they've heard from politicians for months about coronavirus. They don't trust politicians at all, even the one that they voted for.
Dr. Ilopre, can you help pull this apart a little bit from a public health perspective? First off, we're in public health circles. Does this come as a surprise, this concern and this reluctance amongst this particular group of people?
You know, I don't really think anyone's surprised by this. I think that even in the beginning, when we were seeing early polling, trying to understand which communities would have hesitancy towards vaccines, a lot of emphasis and publicity was placed on Black and brown communities. But it was noted that there was also hesitancy amongst this group as well. I think that what we've seen that's been different is that there has been a grassroots effort with Black community members, especially leaders and trusted figures within Black communities, going out and having multiple town halls, as well as Latinx communities, to try to change opinions and really, I think, spread knowledge in a way that hasn't been done across all communities.
And so just to focus a second on that success story amongst Black and Latinx communities, what exactly, you said it's part of it is that there's been this effort. What are some of the details of that effort that succeed that might then translate to other hesitant groups?
You know, we've seen this with other pandemics before in other countries as well. When you have opinion leaders go out and have multiple town halls and change the opinions of people within their social circle so that people can go out to their friends and families and say, I heard from this trusted person within our community about the vaccine and I'm going to get it. You slowly see this diffusion of innovation where opinions change across the community. And it often takes more than one time. I think we have to get that same leadership on the other side across the aisle, going out and having these multiple town halls, these multiple personable discussions, so that you have this change across social circles.
Dan, how do we understand all the sort of contours of the hesitancy amongst Republicans? Is it just about COVID vaccines, or is there a larger vaccine skepticism at play?
You know, Kai, I was asking about that because I think in the popular imagination, anyone who doesn't want to get a COVID vaccine after this horrible year that we've been through, what must they be thinking? And I know that I am so eager to go get my shot. But Republicans that I've spoken to, both in this story recently about the focus group and certainly before, they're insistent. They are not against all vaccines. They're nervous about this one because of how fast it was developed and how much they think politics has played a role in coronavirus. So mm-hmm. They said in this focus group they've gotten shots for other, say, childhood diseases. They've had their kids go get shots. It's just the coronavirus vaccine that they're balking at for now.
Which on some level is hopeful, right? That means that, in fact, some of the things that Dr. Elopre is talking about might work, that you could that this is a persuadable question as opposed to something that is based in ideology.
I think it's totally hopeful. The focus group that I watched, Kai, I've done some interesting reporting, I think, over the past year. It was certainly on the short list of most fascinating experiences reporting during the pandemic. There were 20 Trump voters who came in. One dropped off pretty quickly. But of the 19 left, nearly all of them were more likely, if not very interested, in getting the vaccine at the end of this 2.5-hour focus group, which suggests that there are ways to reach holdouts and skeptics. It just may take persistence and the right messenger.
Right. So we're talking about Republicans and the polling there. But Dan, are there other notable trends in who is and is not willing to get vaccinated that we should be aware of?
Well, I think the doctor is correct that there has been broad concern about communities of color and some of the hesitancy that showed up in earlier polls. So that is trending in the right direction. And in speaking to public health messaging experts, a lot of the concerns are not so different. People have questions about why the coronavirus vaccine came along so quickly. I think there are good answers, including that the work that led into the coronavirus vaccine was not so different than other vaccines. It just red tape was cut to get rid of what usually would be empty spaces, months of waiting, perhaps, between approvals and trial results. The other issue that I think cuts across groups is simply access and where one might go to get the vaccine. At this point in the process, average doctors are not administering shots. You might have to go to a big vaccination site. And that would very much change not just the messaging, but how folks are making the decision to get the shot. If it's with someone that they've been getting medical care for years, that would seem to augur a lot better.
Right. Dr. Lopre, some European countries just announced they'd be suspending the use of the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine. How does news like that land in this context? Do you worry that that will further vaccine hesitancy in the population in general?
I do. You know, I actually just did a town hall where that was brought up, and the question as to why it hasn't been in the news that people are dying after they get the vaccine. And I tried in that town hall to really, again, spread information and knowledge that we unfortunately have adverse events with vaccines across the board. It's just not publicized. And because COVID is so much in the news right now, and the pandemic is at the forefront of everyone's minds, we're hearing about all of these bad outcomes, but in actuality, you look at outcomes across vaccines, it's actually less than what we've seen with COVID compared to flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And what about the details, just so people get it, of the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine? What exactly do we need to know about the risks or not?
You know, I think that whenever anybody chooses to get a vaccine, it's interesting. It's become so normal to say, okay, I'm going to get my childhood vaccines. I'm going to get my flu vaccine. And we don't always think about the risk that's associated with getting a vaccine. And with COVID, we are in a state where we're always thinking about the risk. But I would really encourage people to think and pay attention to what the death toll has been when it comes to the pandemic. And overall, that individual risk, yes, take it into account, but think about your loved ones that you've lost or your friends that have died in isolation. I think from a greater picture, from a greater goal, we have to take that into consideration from a public health standpoint.
Dan, the Biden administration is launching this huge push now to combat vaccine hesitancy. What do you expect to hear, and what do you think will work?
The Biden team has been working on this push for some weeks. My understanding is it's still a little bit away, but there have been multiple messaging campaigns from folks like the Ad Council, this private sector consortium that is running ads across media. And the messages, Kai, I think are pretty consistent that vaccines overall are safe. This one is as safe and tested as others have been. It went through trials with tens of thousands of people last year, that health professionals, doctors, they're overwhelmingly getting the shot when they are given the opportunity. That seems to reassure Americans. And then, as the doctor just said, this is about recapturing moments that were lost, getting back to being with family that you might not have seen in months. And getting a shot is a path back to normalcy.
Right. Well, we will all need them in order to get back to that normalcy. So let's hope we can get there. Dan Diamond is a national reporter investigating health, politics, and policy for The Washington Post. And Dr. Leticia Ilopre is an assistant professor of infectious disease at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thanks to both of you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Since former President Trump lost the general election in November, a number of high-profile Republican lawmakers have repeated his unfounded claims that the election was stolen. Using these false claims of widespread voter fraud as an excuse, Republicans across the country have introduced more than 250 bills that would make it harder to vote. And even though Texas already has some of the strictest voting rules in the country, Republican lawmakers in the state have proposed 24 bills that aim to take it a step further. At the federal level, Democrats in the House of Representatives passed H.R. 1, which would make it easier to register to vote and stay registered to vote, curb gerrymandering, enfranchise former felons, and more. But it is not likely that such a comprehensive bill will make its way through a 50-50 Senate. Joining me now is Congressman Colin Allred, who represents Texas's 32nd District. Congressman, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Kai.
So Republicans in Texas have sponsored more than 24 election bills aimed at restricting access to voters. Walk us through some of the changes proposed by state lawmakers.
Well, I think what we're seeing is an effort to target the types of voting that Democratic voters disproportionately took advantage of, and particularly in Harris County, where they did some fantastic things to try and expand the hours available for voting and the ways that people could vote. So they're trying to ban, for example, counties from proactively sending out absentee ballot applications. They're trying to restrict early voting hours just to a certain window from 7 to 7. Harris County, for example, had a 24-hour voting location It was a big deal that drew a lot of attention to the fact that an election was going on. And while not a lot of folks were voting at, you know, 4 in the morning, it created a lot of interest. They also are getting rid of things like drive-through voting, which some counties implemented to try and protect folks during the pandemic and allow them to vote from their car, which was also taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. So these are all efforts really to target the expansion of voting hours and locations and to make it more accessible for folks to vote.
Harris County is Houston, we should say. And so are you suggesting there that these rules will differentially impact those larger cities and therefore also Black and Latino voters?
Well, absolutely. And what we see in the voting rights space, and you know, I was a voting rights attorney before I came to Congress, is that efforts like this, it's like a hydraulic system where if you press on one section of the system, all you do is squeeze pressure onto other sections of it. So if you restrict vote by mail, if you restrict early voting, then you push more pressure onto election day. And what we've seen historically in Texas is we already have extremely long lines on election day. We certainly did in 2020 and in 2018, and we've had it in every election that I have done voting rights in Texas. But we try to ameliorate that through expanding early voting, through trying to get as many folks as possible voting by mail who are eligible. And so these restrictions will put more pressure on election day, which will disproportionately impact Black and Latino voters in our big cities. And of course, if these laws go through and there's nothing done at the federal level, you will see extremely long lines in Texas, and you'll see folks who will not be able to wait that long.
Right. Each branch of state government in Texas is controlled by Republicans. It seems like these laws will certainly pass then, right? I mean, are there Republicans in the state who would break ranks on this and say this is bad for democracy?
You know, I would certainly hope so. And I'll tell you why, Kai, because we had 11 million Texans vote in 2020. It was enormous turnout for us. We still have a lot of room to grow in terms of getting to the numbers where we want to be. But Republicans still won in Texas. If you're at the Senate level, you know, they won by nearly 10 points. You know, President Trump won by 5.5 points here with enormous turnout. And so I don't think that Texas Republicans should be afraid of turnout. I think they should embrace it. And I think, of course, that's, in my opinion, the way democracy should work in general. But I do hope that there are some voices in the Republican Party who will say, listen, this turnout wasn't just Democrats coming out to vote. We still won these elections, and we can be confident that when everybody comes out, we still have a chance to win.
That is a head scratcher you raised, though. I mean, what is this actually about, given that Republicans won widely in Texas? President Trump won by more than 5 points as well. What exactly is the frenzy to change voting rules? I mean, I guess it would suggest that Republicans are saying, yeah, there really is a problem.
Well, there's a few things going on. Number one, there's an effort to not appear to be not part of the club when every other Republican state is passing restrictive voting laws. And, you know, Texas Republicans don't want to be left out of that. And we have some with, you know, presidential ambitions. We have some who want to just appear to be the most quote unquote conservative in the country. They're also, of course, looking at the demographic numbers here in Texas and knowing that at some point it's going to be very difficult for those numbers, if they continue as the trend is now, for them to keep winning statewide by these same margins. And so I think there's some concern that while they may have done well in this election, that they may not do so well in the future. And, you know, that's not a legitimate reason to restrict the right to vote. And, you know, we have an attorney general here and a governor who have been talking about voter fraud for their entire careers and who spent enormous amounts of effort and energy trying to find voter fraud and could not find any. And so it's really a solution in search of a problem.
I mentioned H.R. 1 earlier this month. You and your colleagues in the House passed this bill. How would this bill impact what's happening in Texas? If that were to become law, what would it change there?
It would change everything because H.R. 1 is really about setting national standards. And that's really when you think about the voting, affirmative voting expansion that we do in H.R. 1, it's really about setting standards of what states can and can't do, and then trying to create a floor so that our democracy isn't radically different from, you know, one state to another. So H.R. 1, you know, as you, I think, mentioned, ends things like voter purges and partisan gerrymandering, but it also sets up national standards around early voting hours, vote by mail availability. And so that would really target what we're seeing here. It would try to prevent those kinds of attacks on the right to vote. And, you know, this is something that's within our power in the Congress to set these national standards, and for states to then have flexibility within those standards to do what they always do, which is, you know, to administer the election. But this is something that we need to do, because what we're seeing now is really unprecedented. And I would want to stress that, that this is not a normal level of voting changes and laws around voting that's being passed, not just in Texas, but in states across the country. This is really unprecedented. We have not seen this level of restrictions coming forward since the Jim Crow era.
So, Congressman, with the 50-50 split in the Senate and a 60-person threshold to get H.R. 1 to the president's desk, it's not very realistic that that bill will become law in its current iteration, at least. Does that frustrate you?
Well, I do want to take a little bit, I disagree a little bit with the premise there. I don't think that we should necessarily just say that this is going to have to go through 60 votes to get through the Senate. I think that President Biden and key senators have already discussed changes that may need to be made to the filibuster to allow a bill like H.R. 1 to get to the president's desk. And I think they should be considered, because when you look at the history of the filibuster and the way it was used to prevent civil rights legislation, anti-lynching legislation from passing for a century post-Civil War era, you know, this is something that the legacy of the filibuster directly impacts also voting rights. And I think in a way that specifically it needs to be dealt with. And the Senate has created exceptions to the filibuster for nominations, now for judicial nominations, for the Supreme Court. I think they should do as well for voting rights, or as President Biden has have suggested, change the nature of the filibuster so that it's not just you declare that you're going to have one, but what you actually have to stand up and talk and try to gum up the works in that way. I think that would allow H.R. 1 to have a better chance of getting through the Senate.
How far would you be willing to go? Would you support abandoning the filibuster? I mean, I know you're not in the Senate, but would you support abandoning the filibuster altogether?
Well, in my opinion, I think the current structure of the filibuster is unconstitutional. I don't think it's consistent also with the traditional way it has been used in the Senate for most of our history. It has now become a supermajority on every piece of legislation that comes to the Senate. And that really was not the case for most of our history. The filibuster was used very sparingly. And as I said, unfortunately, it was usually only used to block civil rights legislation. The fact that it's now used on every single piece of legislation by both Democrats and Republicans has really changed the nature of the Senate and made it a much less efficient and functioning body. That being said, I don't think that we will see the filibuster entirely gotten rid of in this Congress. I think we'll see adjustments made to it, and that's what I'm advocating for here. I think that there need to be certain adjustments to allow critical legislation to get through, because they impact the fundamentals of our democracy. You know, if you think a Supreme Court justice is a fundamental tenet of our democracy and that has to be able to get through without a supermajority, I would argue that voting rights legislation should as well.
You are a moderate Democrat who won a seat that was held by a Republican for 15 years. And a lot of the national conversation, at least inside the Democratic Party, is that the party has to be careful not to put people like you in your seat in danger by doing too much, by doing things like abandoning the filibuster or changing the filibuster too much. What can you tell us about the tension there?
Well, first of all, I don't think I have very many constituents who are aware of what the filibuster rule really is and how it's been used to restrict how things are happening in Washington. What they see mostly is gridlock and dysfunction, and they don't like that. I can tell you that that's the number one thing I hear, which is, you know, why can't y'all just get together and get something done? And of course, we do pass a lot of legislation in the House that doesn't even get a hearing in the Senate. Legislation that's very popular, that has the overwhelming support of the American people, that even gets bipartisan votes in the House. But because it can't get a supermajority in the Senate, it doesn't get through. So that to me is less of a concern. I think we have to meet the needs of the American people in this moment and respond to what is an unprecedented crisis in terms of our democracy. You know, I was on the House floor on January 6th when the insurrectionists, you know, tried to get in. I saw us, you know, barring the doors, using furniture and having to, you know, be escorted to a secure location, and really not even knowing at that time just how close we came to an extreme violence event. And I think our democracy is very fragile right now. And I think the answer to that is sunlight. The answer to that is to expand the right to vote. The answer to that is to affirm our belief in our democratic principles. And that is the opposite of that is happening at the state level across the country. And so if we don't address these bills and this legislation, it's not going to be, you know, seats like mine that are going to be in danger. It's going to be our very democracy. And that, to me, is much more important.
Congressman, thank you for taking the time to join me.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Congressman Colin Allred represents Texas's 32nd District.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kai Wright, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Violence in our culture and society is all too common. Just yesterday in Atlanta, at least 8 people were shot and killed, the majority of them Asian women. This identity-based violence seems to be constant, and violence against women in particular comes with its own burden. Most women are brought up to take precautions to avoid violence when walking alone, especially at night, taking a well-lit road, wearing clothes you can run in, and checking in with someone to share your whereabouts. 33-year-old Sarah Everard did all these things when she disappeared on March 3rd while walking home in London. A week later, she was found dead. After her killing, police went door-to-door in her neighborhood, telling women to stay inside for their own safety. That resulted in outrage and frustration from many women demanding that police create safer streets rather than telling women to stay home. That feeling of wanting men to take more responsibility for creating safe spaces has resonated internationally, and we reached out to our female listeners to hear about some of the things you've had to do to protect your own safety. A warning to our listeners, some of these calls contain testimony about sexual violence.
Yes, I've definitely felt unsafe in public spaces as a woman. Basically, since I hit puberty, all my life, I've been groped on the city bus. I've been trailed by 2 men in a cargo van telling me to get in and come with them. I've been told to avoid certain public places if I'm alone. I've been told to dress conservatively so as not to attract the wrong kind of attention. I've been told to walk with my keys in my hand just in case I need to get away quickly, or with them poking between my fingers in case I need to defend myself. I've been told to aim for the nose and the groin since I'm small and won't be able to fight a man off. I've been told not to fight, just to stay alive. What I want to know is, why is the onus on me to avoid being a victim and not on society to raise men who don't attack? Or better yet, men who are respectful and can express their emotions and needs in healthy ways without resorting to violence.
This is Sue Leone from Raleigh, North Carolina. I was raped by my boyfriend when I was a teenager. And so ever since then, I have really been aware of being safe. And so at night, I definitely check under my car in a parking lot, especially if I'm working late or it's the only car in that area. And I'll look under the car from 20 feet away just to make sure that it's just pavement.
Hi, my name is Alicia Prieto and I am calling from Ohio. Because of what I do for a living, I go into rooms with only men all the time, and it just, you have that feeling of just not being safe. However, it's really nothing compared to growing up in Mexico and how unsafe I felt there, and how a couple of times I had to jump out of moving vehicles, or I was chasing in the streets by men. So that does not mean that it's okay. I think it would be great if this was never an issue that we would have to talk about.
My name is Andrea Thomas, and I'm calling from Lancaster, Texas. I have felt unsafe in spaces as a woman, and what I have started doing is carrying a loaded 380 for my protection.
Hi, this is Beth from Worcester, Massachusetts. Everything I learned about dealing with men in a public space, or at least a lot of it, I learned in Girl Scouts. My Girl Scout leader was a huge proponent of making sure that our late middle school, high school age troop was aware of how to deal with themselves, deal with self-defense, deal with date rape drugs, don't leave your drink alone, how to tell, you know, maybe your drink is a little bit fizzy if you left alone, that they also did self-defense workshops, and she would always talk to us, okay, if you're walking away from somewhere, you're in a public place, but you're alone and you're in heels, take the heels off, walk barefoot, always scan for the exits, always know how to leave a room, make yourself as unattractive to that human as possible so they don't find you, they don't take you. And that's really screwed up that we would have to know that as a high school age kid or college age woman or any woman.
We also reached out to our male listeners and asked if you've thought about what you can do to help women feel safer in public spaces.
My name is John. I'm from Dallas. I am 6'7" and pushing 300 pounds. I'm a big guy. If I see single individuals, I try to cross to the other side of the road. Don't know what it's like to be afraid. And I don't want anyone else to be afraid because of my size.
Hi there. If I'm walking down the sidewalk, I will move to one side. I think it's important to understand the experiences that everyone shares that are kind of universal about feeling unsafe in the presence of men.
In order to make women feel safe, we should teach our children to be better people.
Hi, this is Tom from Brooklyn. And in terms of helping women feel safer in public spaces, I walk my dog twice a day, if not more, every single day. And I try and be as cognizant as possible of people who are in front of me, specifically women, and ensuring that I make everyone around me feel as comfortable as I can. And that means not walking too closely to them and crossing the street whenever it feels like a person may be feeling uncomfortable with the people behind them.
And we got a few more responses from men on Twitter that we found interesting. Here, for instance, is Jamal Alexis Downer, who wrote, "I do think about it, but as a large black man who grew up in white spaces, I developed a habit of going out of my way to make people feel comfortable with my mere existence. These two considerations often come into conflict." So lots of stuff to think about, and thank you for your thoughts on this. Joining us today is Kate Mann, an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University and the author of an article in The Atlantic called "What Sarah Everard's Murder Illuminates and Might Obscure." Kate, violence against women, unfortunately and horrifically, is commonplace. It happens all the time. What do you think about this case in particular resonated so much with people?
I mean, part of what's resonating is obviously that this is a terrible tragedy. We should all mourn Sarah Everard and protest the kind of violence which took her life from us so wrongly and prematurely. I do think there are probably other factors too driving our reaction to the case. In part, I think there is a prevalent misconception that stranger abductions, rapes, murders are more common than is actually the case, in contrast to the much more common form of violence done by men known to their female victims.
Mm-hmm. And more than 90% of female homicide victims know their murderers, it's worth pointing out. So why is that, that we don't focus on that part of it often enough?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I mean, in addition to that statistic, half of female homicide victims are murdered by their former or intimate partners, which makes the most common case very unlike this stranger abduction and murder. We also know that about 3/4 of rapes are committed by men known to, again, a female victim. you know, I think part of it is that we have trouble making sense, as the philosopher Audrey Yap has argued, of non-standard stories of sexual assault and homicide. We have a kind of paradigm of the stranger, kidnapping, rape, murder in mind, and we find that easier to parse. And we're more reluctant to believe that violence can happen close to home with men that women trust, and who may be trusted members of our community. But it's of course vital to remember that in the Sarah Everard case as well, the man accused of her abduction and murder, who'll stand trial in October, he was a trusted member of his community. He was a police officer. He was a father of two, a husband, and described as a nice bloke by his neighbor. So it's important to recognize that, unfortunately, some of the men who do grave violence to women are very much amongst us and are not some kind of quote-unquote monster who lurks in the bushes.
Where did this narrative come from that women are responsible for creating their own safety?
I think it's part of a more general way in which we tend to expect women to be the ones to adapt to circumstances of injustice or inconvenience and take on certain burdens that generally we expect men will have their freedoms much less curtailed. I mean, we see this kind of general pattern play out even in the pandemic, as we've all had to make massive adjustments to how we work and live, and in the case of couples with children, raise their and school our children. We've seen that in the case of heterosexual couples, women are the ones adapting. Women are the ones homeschooling, in effect, and dropping out of the workplace, particularly for the most vulnerable women, namely women of color. Whereas men are often seen as entitled to maintain their basic lifestyles. And so I think that has broader repercussions when it comes to the fact that when we have these public discussions of safety, we expect women to be less free to move around in the world and to be prudent in ways that don't correspond to asking men to change their behaviors, including taking responsibility for not putting women in fear for their lives.
It's a chilling idea that, you know, we go back now, what, 100 and some odd years on the idea that public space is not for women, is what you're saying. That it ultimately boils down to that.
Yeah. The entitlement to take up space, it has subtle forms and it has more obvious and sweeping forms. But, you know, it's instantiated in sort of simple and somewhat, you know, we refer tongue in cheek to things like man spreading. But again, you see instantiated in that the sense that men are entitled to take up space, particularly white men and men who are otherwise privileged with respect to being cis and straight and non-disabled. We find that men in those privileged demographics are seen as entitled to be and take up space in public space.
Well, speaking of men, you know, we asked our listeners to respond to this case. We got just a real outpouring. We did get one question on Twitter that I want to put to you. One listener asked, if someone would tell me what to do, I'd be happy to help. What can men do? How would you respond to that?
You know, I think a really good start is not only by asking that question, but by listening attentively to the outpouring of stories. So something we know is that around 97% of women, and I think this probably also applies to many non-binary people, are subject to street harassment. And I think this is a similar moment to the one that we saw during the Me Too reckoning in late 2017, when Tarana Burke's movement that she'd led for over a decade was popularized. I think this is a chance to really listen to the stories of people who are the most vulnerable while out in public, which includes girls, women, and as I mentioned, non-binary people, and to know that it might not be that you can do anything concrete, but having the knowledge in the back of your mind of what women and girls face is something that can make you much more sensitive on future occasions to ways in which you might be able to be a good ally or accomplice to vulnerable women and girls, and also ways in which you might represent a threat despite the fact that you have good intentions and would never do anything threatening. It's not always something that people can know. So it might be appropriate to do things like cross the street rather than walk behind a woman at night. That's one example of behavior that men who are not on the defensive might welcome as one way to combat the justified fear that many women feel while out in public.
Kate Mann is an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University and author of an article in The Atlantic called What Sarah Everard's Murder Illuminates and Might Obscure. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Y'all, yes. My beloveds, yes. This is real. Yes. This is live. Yes. This is three-dimensional. Yes.
Actor Andre DeShields there taking part in something many of us haven't experienced in a long time, a live in-person performance.
Whoa.
DeShields was part of an outdoor pop-up show in Times Square this week, one of a number of cultural events taking place this spring in New York City, as part of a statewide effort to revitalize the arts sector. New York is also one of a growing number of states that are slowly allowing the return of limited capacity indoor performances starting this spring. That's in addition to other states like Texas and Mississippi that are currently allowing venues to operate at full capacity. And while public health experts continue to urge caution, particularly when it comes to indoor events, there is a growing hope that the warmer weather, along with more vaccinations, can open up more possibilities for artists in the months ahead. Here with me now is Charles Williams, a pianist based in Kansas City and a board member for the American Jazz Museum. Charles, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Miranda Heyman, a theater writer and director based here in New York. Good to have you, Miranda.
Thanks for having me as well.
So, Charles, you are in Missouri, where live concerts have been allowed to take place since last May. Have you performed in front of any audiences, either indoors or outdoors, since the state allowed concerts to start back up?
If I have, it's been at a very small capacity, but most likely everything's really been kind of canceled.
What do you miss about it? Assuming you missed something about it prior to the pandemic, what did you get from a live audience as a performer?
You miss the energy that you get from the audience, because audience, you know, injects energy into the artist, and that makes them perform even just that much more. Because there are people there, people present. You can just feel the vibe from each other.
There's a charm. You need to, even as an audience member, you know, there's this connection with the artists that just doesn't exist over a screen, I guess.
Yes, it's like a heart-to-heart thing, you know?
Miranda, as a theater director, what did the audience mean to you before the pandemic?
Well, I mean, the audience was, you know, the whole point of the thing, really. Theater is defined as live bodies in a shared space. So what is theater without that? That's been a question that I've certainly been asking myself. And I think the industry, as we move through Zoom theater and pre-recorded stuff as well, is really contending with what is our art form right now without liveness.
Mm-hmm. You're in the early stages of planning out a theater installation for this summer that could have a live in-person audience. What's it feel like? What's it feel like to get back to directing after a year without in-person shows?
It's scary, to be honest. Scary to be the first. I will say that we are taking the utmost precautions, and we aren't planning on even having any live performers to, you know, really keep the audiences and everyone involved safe. But it's exciting. I did a site visit earlier this year, and I was surprised at how emotional it was to be in a theater space again, even empty and even, you know, darkened and dusty. It was really powerful. So I'm excited to be able to welcome folks back to just that. Even, you know, even if we don't end up putting on anything, it was just nice to be there again.
Right. You said it was scary. I assume you mean the health risk, but did you also mean just the fact of doing a performance live?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, as anyone would feel being the first of anything, right? There's a lot of pressure on us. And also with the reckoning of racial injustice and systemic oppression that is, you know, theater is also susceptible to, we really have a lot to say when we come back about what we want to not only do and how we want to reach our audiences more accessibly and safely, but also how we want to speak to everything that's happened in the past year and really create something of a template of how to move forward.
Yeah. Charles, what about that? I mean, as people come back in this particular moment, I mean, whenever we get back in this particular moment, it seems like I imagine this will show up in everybody's art, this moment we've been through. What do you think? How's it going to show up in your work, you think?
Well, I just hope that there'll be a greater appreciation for live music during this time. But we've learned a lot of things have been taken for granted. The musicians here will have more of an opportunity to play more once things start to open back up a little bit more. And people will be more appreciative. I'm not saying that they're not, but I'm talking about people that hire musicians. Maybe like, hey, this is what kept us busy. This is what kept us, you know, putting food in front of the people while they listen to music, you know, to have entertainment, that it might open maybe some better doors for musicians to have more gigs. Also, young musicians that are learning this art form, and how encouraged are they behind knowing, are they going to have a future in the arts, you know? Yeah.
Do you feel like when you think about spring and summer, does getting back in front of live audiences seem like a possibility to you?
It seems like a greater possibility, more of maybe a bigger crowd. We've actually started to do some things here in Kansas City where we just had a concert Saturday night at our gym theater. And we had Denise Times in, and we allowed 100 people to come in to watch that show, but we social dissed in the auditorium. And it was a great vibe there, you know, even with her and her musicians, you know, got to talk to them afterward, and they were happy. They were there to play, you know, and just be in front of a crowd, of even though it wasn't a big crowd. But
yeah. Miranda, I wonder if all of this, when folks get back, will prompt rethinking of live performances in general, if there's something new that's going to come out of this, just about how people perform live. Do you think so? And if so, what might change?
You know, the thing I'm most excited about is that as live performances are coming back, folks are really still thinking about how to maintain an at-home experience for folks who still might not feel comfortable coming out, or, you know, for folks whom it is still dangerous, or they have other access needs that don't make sense for them to come in person. So I feel really excited that many theater companies, as they're talking about reopening, are still talking about maintaining a digital season and doing digital programming, and even having an at-home experience that runs parallel to what is happening in person. I mean, that's what we're talking about too, right? So yeah. I feel excited about the permanence of the, how do we continue to create digital media, and how can that have, you know, seasons be so much more abundant and rich and accessible?
It's certainly been cool to access a lot of stuff that I never would have gotten before the pandemic. So Charles, I cannot be with a musician here and not take the opportunity to sneak in a hit of music, something sort of kind of like live, I guess. Can you play us something that you would be excited to play when you get a chance to be with a live audience again?
Gosh, there's so many things, but I can just play you a little something here named My Wild Irish Rose. It's an older tune, but we put a little jazz flair onto this.
Wonderful. Charles, that is so beautiful and good for my soul on a day of hard news. Charles Williams is a pianist based in Kansas City and a board member for the American Jazz Museum. And Miranda Heyman is a theater writer and director based here in New York. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
And that's all we have for you today, folks. It is St. Patrick's Day today, so if you celebrate, have fun, be safe. Maybe put on that green mask. Really appreciate you listening. I'm here with you tomorrow, and Tanzina is back in the chair on Friday. If you missed anything or want to listen back, you can check out our podcast. You can find it wherever you find your pods, or head over to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Kai Wright, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.